Welcome, everybody, to All About Symbian. This is Insight Podcast number 156, allaboutsymbian.com. We're recording this on Monday, the 7th of March, 2011. I'm Steve Litchfield in the hot chair up in Edinburgh, I have.
It's a hot chair, is it? It's Ewan Spence. Hello, everybody.
Well, Ewan won't be there for 3 weeks. He'll be jet-packing across America, apparently.
It's 11 days, not 3 weeks, but don't tell Rafe.
There was me thinking we'd got rid of you for 3 weeks. So, up in hell we have.
In the wooden chair, it's David Gilson.
And in the wicker chair in Sussex we have.
It's Rafe Blanford.
Oh, please, can we have Christopher Lee on now as well?
A bit of news. Before we get to that, just a note about our continuing E7 review. David Gilson has had his several review parts. I'm in the middle of writing up the final review part, which I've got to summarise this rather interesting device and also roll up the applications like mapping and navigation, which haven't been done so far. So look out for that this week on the site. Ewan is prohibited from mentioning E7 in this podcast. He's got to save all his thoughts for his video series of reviews coming up over the next 11 days.
Well, I'm just going to say one thing. I was right about the volume switch, Stephen. You were wrong.
Oh, so you're another volume switch fan. Okay, okay. That's cool.
Yes, I like being able to change the volume on my device. Yes, I'm a fan.
There we go. More from Ewan on the E7. Look forward to his uniquely stylish video series coming up on the site very shortly. On with some news. On with some news. Digia and Qt. Rafe, this is right up your street, and it happened this morning as we recorded it. What's new?
Right, the news here is that Nokia has come to an agreement with Digia, which is a Finnish software company, to sell the commercial licensing and professional services parts of Qt to Digia. So just to explain in a little more detail what that means, Qt is obviously the Nokia software framework that we've been talking about a lot in the podcast in the past, and actually comes in terms of commercial development. There's two ways you can license it, if you like. There's LGPL, which is sort of open source but a relatively permissive license, so you can do commercial development with it. And then there's a kind of a pure Qt commercial license, as it's called, and it's that Qt commercial license part of the business, or rather it's really just a licensing area that has been sold to Digia, and going with that is professional services. And in one sense, that's a fancy word for technical support. This is if a company's building a Qt based product, solution, whatever, and they want to get some expert help in from the outside. That's when the professional services department comes in. The reason Nokia have done this is, well, there's really two major factors here. One is it wants to focus on the kind of the core development of Qt, particularly from a mobile point of view. And I think the second reason is really about, you know, those kind of commercial licensing and professional services aren't really a core part of the Nokia business. You know, they're not really looking to make revenue out of that kind of thing. They really see Qt as an enabling technology. I think you can draw a very similar parallel to something that happened when Nokia acquired Symbian. That was the sale of the professional services unit to Accenture, and the professional services unit of Symbian was actually the bit of Symbian that made the most money in terms of revenue, and it's what gave Symbian pretty healthy profits late on its life as an independent company. And so what are the implications for this? Well, really also is good news for those Qt developers who are interested in the desktop and the embedded services. You know, when people ask about, well, where does that come in? Well, a lot of desktop applications actually make use of Qt, and that includes a lot in this kind of filmmaking in the 3D space. Maya's a good example, but there are many others as well. There's a lot of applications and sort of services that, sort of, if you like, behind closed doors, that are used in the pharmaceutical industry, in the defense industry, in appliances and elsewhere. And so embedded is stuff like Qt can be used in printers or video phone systems and many others, and all of those tend to use this commercial license. The reason they do that is because it gives them a greater degree of flexibility. They don't necessarily have to contribute changes to Qt back into the kind of the open source pool, and they can also, for things like medical devices in particular, sell product warranties. And there's various reasons why open source might not be viable. So for Qt as a whole, I think this is pretty good news, because it does rather address this question of, you know, why should Nokia invest in this desktop embedded space where it really doesn't have any reason to do so. And as part of this agreement, Digia's sort of signal that it will be making significant investments there, because obviously that's where it'll be able to make money on this commercial licensing side of thing. I think at the same time, it's worth pointing out that this really reaffirms Nokia's commitment to Qt as a, you know, something it wants to take forward and continue to invest in. I mean, we already know it's important in the next few years in Symbian and selling those next 150 million devices, being the enabler for the software updates. But also going forward, it's MeeGo and the kind of the third portion of Nokia's software strategy, which we haven't talked about much, but we probably should do in the future, which is to sort of engage with disruptive technologies as they emerge. And the idea is that MeeGo and Qt will be used for that. And so sort of the idea that Nokia isn't interested in Qt anymore really isn't true. There's a short-term interest in Symbian for obvious reasons, and we all know about that. But there's also a longer-term one for Qt and MeeGo, and clearly that's less defined at the moment. But to suggest that Nokia has no interest in Qt at all is just simply not true. Clearly there are changes with the Windows Phone thing, and there will continue to be people asking about porting of Qt to Windows Phone. That's not going to happen mainly for fragmentation reasons, says Nokia. But nonetheless, all quite interesting stuff there. And I think it puts Qt sort of on a much more feasible and sustainable way to get companies continuing to use it to build their own products and services, quite apart from any Nokia activity. And for Qt as a whole, that's good because it, you know, continues to build the developer pool and all of that. There are more details of this on the side. I appreciate it's a relatively technical topic, but I think really the takeaway from this for people listening to this podcast is it really is indicative of Nokia's continuing support for Qt, but also helps bring Qt into a sort of more, as I say, sustainable and feasible model for the future for stuff that's happening for Qt outside of Nokia's particular area of interest.
Just to hopefully reassure any open source developers listening, as I understand the licensing model for Qt, we have the the commercial licensing model where companies have to pay royalty, and that's if they want to make any changes to the Qt code and not contribute them back and use them in a proprietary fashion. And there is the limited GPL model for the whole open source community. We pretty much knew what Nokia's intentions were with Qt, so the community could more or less trust them. Do we know what the legal situation is with Digi, as in could they revoke the LGPL license in any way?
That's a good question, Dave. No, the LGPL license stays with Nokia, and indeed that will be the main way in which Qt is released. You know, that will continue to be what's used for releasing, you know, Qt, the components and the SDK and all of that. What, in theory, Digia could choose to fork Qt and release it themselves under their own license, but it would be unlikely that they would choose to do so simply because it wouldn't make a lot of business sense to break off from the LGPL. And as you say, there is also this new GPL aspect as well. That's purely for open source, but commercial development can still take place under the LGPL license. Indeed, that's the way the majority of Symbian Amigo applications are developed. I mean, the vast majority, 99.9%, I would imagine. And as I say, the commercial stuff is really about the embedded and the desktop solutions. So, I mean, in theory, Digia could choose to sort of close off any future developments it did in the desktop area, but as I say, I think that's pretty unlikely given, you know, the obvious benefits they get from Qt being a wider technology pool than that. I mean, Digia have a pretty good track record in the open source community as well, so I think looking at their kind of modus operandi, that would be very unlikely indeed. You can't obviously predict the future absolutely, but in the sense that there will be continuity provided by Nokia through the LGPL stuff, that's still going to remain whatever Digia choose to do. I think to a large extent this was about reassuring some of the users of Qt outside the mobile area, which is actually in one sense the most successful bit of Qt, and that's going to continue to be the case, I think. So I don't think there are any major concerns there, David.
It's also a practical point of view as well. If you've written an application in Qt for, say, a defense contractor that has some sort of encryption involved, you don't want to publish that bit open source.
Well, that,
because it might be a bit of a problem if there's a war on.
Yeah, that's a good example. There are plenty of other, you know, examples like that where you don't want to publish a source code reasons. Obviously, you can still keep LGPL-based Qt you know, closed source. You don't have to release that. But it's obviously the additions to Qt that some companies would want to keep private. And as I say, it's also about warranties and indemnities. For example, in the medical field, when you're creating a medical appliance, you know, there are certain legal requirements that come in. And as, you know, I think everyone's probably aware, open source makes sense in some business situations, but doesn't in others. And you do need to have the flexibility to support both if you're going to have a fully healthy ecosystem that spans, you know, from the, you know, pure open source area with things like KDE into sort of commercial things like mobile applications in MIGO and Symbian. Again, that'll be the LGPL up to, as you say, the defense contractors or the medical stuff, which is more likely to come under this Qt commercial license. And I think, indeed, that kind of that flexibility and that breadth has been one of Qt's strength over the years, and I would assume will continue to be so.
I know. I'll just chip in as well with a security point of view. It's, I mean, keeping security closed sourced, especially even in situations of water, I'm not entirely convinced that is the right way to go, because you are relying on a bit of security for obscurity. I mean, I think some of the best encryption algorithms we have, it's like AES, Rheindahl, are actually open source, and because you do actually have the scrutiny of crowds on them.
Indeed, David, that's a debate, I think, that probably apart from this Qt announcement. But yes, I think it would probably be fair to say, I think even the most hardened open source advocate would admit there are cases in the current context where open source doesn't make a sense from a business point of view. You can argue that, you know, you could change that by changing the business model and changing the way it works, but just with the way things work at the moment, you know, you do need this sort of duality.
I think it's also fair to point out that we actually have the greatest encryption system that the world has ever known. It's called Her Majesty's Civil Service, and they've decided we're not doing open source because that is evil and nasty. We shall therefore do this route instead. David, never discount pure cock-up in British government for commissioning than the basic understanding of open and public key encryption.
Oh, certainly. I mean, the number of keys that USB drives that have been left around on trains, and I'm thinking, guys, just use TrueCrypt. It doesn't cost anything.
Now, what I'd like to do here is put in a triumvirate, a trilogy of brief game reviews. So Dave is going to get ready with something with some outrageous sound effects, and Ewan's going to get ready for a game with a hearty roar and a charge down the field. But before we get to that, over on the Obby Daily App blog, we've been doing a few guest reviews for Nokia, looking at some of the titles in their Obby store. And well, I should emphasize that they're not influencing us in any way. They're simply saying, will you write the reviews? You can say whatever you like, good or bad. Now, having said that, I had a real trouble with Sparkle. So it's essentially a clone of Zoomer, or Puzzloop, as it originally came out in 1998, where you whiz your cannon round and it fires coloured marbles out, and they have to match it with marbles that are advancing round a complicated track. I'm sure you know the concept, but I had a real trouble in finding anything wrong with it. It's got the most flawless execution of any game I've ever played, ever, on a handheld platform, on a phone. Really, really impressive. All the cutscenes, all the animations, all the sound effects, even the background plot, tenuous though it was all immaculately done. The screens didn't take forever to load up. It was pretty nifty and pretty speedy. So highly, highly recommended. It's only £2 or £3. Works brilliantly in all the Symbian 3 phones with the graphics acceleration. Do go and try it. Sparkle. And Rafe, you had a quick blast on this as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I was similarly impressed by this. It's actually written in Qt, not that that really matters, but a good example of what can be enabled, you know, from a graphics point of view, and just the smooth transition and the overall speed of the game. There was very little waiting around. As you say, you know, this sort of style of gameplay has been around a long time, but I think this is probably one of the slickest implementations I've seen of it. And what really sort of impressed me as well was this had a lot of value in this game. You know, it would take you many hours to work your way through this game, and there would be nothing to stop you going back and sort of playing again. You know, it's that kind of addictive nature, which I think always serves well. And, you know, the casual gaming nature of it, the fact that you can sort of have a game that lasts just a few minutes, or, you know, do an intensive half-hour session, you know, so it ticks a lot of the boxes for me that, you know, make a great mobile game. And, you know, like you, I was impressed by this. And, you know, it was, you know, it's when a developer puts thoughts in right across the air, you know, so it's sound effects, you know, the gameplay, and doesn't get in the way of you having a good time. That's, you know, that's the hallmark of a game that really stands out. You know, is there anything that could be done to improve it? Maybe some sort of two-player feature or things like that. But, you know, as a one-player game, it's very difficult to think of ways that it could be better.
Absolutely. Now, for our next game review, I need a few sound effects from across the team. So, Ewan, especially, take it away. And Rafe and I together.
Oh, no! Meh!
That's enough. David, take it away with Worms HD.
Right. Okay, Worms HD. Now, are the trendy kids with playing Angry Birds thinking that they're lobbing ballistic objects is, well, we've been doing it 16 years ago with Worms. So it was originally on the Amiga and PC, and now it's on Symbian, and it's £3 in the Obby Store, and I think it's the most fun I've had on a mobile phone game. If you don't know what Worms is, the idea is that there's several teams of Worms who are living in surreal environments with ridiculous weapons, everything from explosives like grenades and bazookas to the holy hand grenade and the pile driving mule statue. And it actually being able to destroy the environment does add another level of complexity to the game. But it is very much like Angry Birds in that you set a level and a power for lobbing your explosives and try not to do friendly fire. But there is also wind as well, so you can try and curl your shots. As with the original PC games, there is a multiplayer mode where there isn't a Bluetooth link up, unfortunately, but the idea has always been that you just take turns on the same device. As I say, it's a really fun game, but the one problem I had with it was learning the new user interface. There is a practice mode, but there's no tutorial mode. So at first, I was a little frustrated getting into it, but that was soon resolved, and I was just sat there laughing my head off playing the game. So I would highly recommend this.
Yeah, yeah. Our third game in our trilogy is a Backbreaker, for which Ewan received a certain amount of criticism in the review. People were expecting a full American football simulation, Ewan.
That's true, Steve. Yes, Backbreaker, of course, is a famous genre brand of American football games. Not as popular as something like Madden on EA, but it is popular on the Xbox and is known for it. So when you see Backbreaker and the graphics that look like an American football pitch with a great big stadium, lots of hulking men who are too scared to play rugby because they put padding on, cliches abound, people might have expected that they were getting an American football game. And they haven't. What they've got is a mobile game that's really very good, but only does a little bit of American football. It's the easiest way to describe it is essentially it's British Bulldog. One bloke at one end of the pitch has to get to the other end. Lots of people are in the way, and literally you have to run past them. You run towards them, side skip left and right, spin around, all the while holding the ball. If any of them tackles you to the ground, you get another go. You get 4 goes to do each level. There's 10 levels in a batch. There's about another 10 batches. So there's 100 levels of gameplay with different strengths of opponents, different paths that you have to follow. And when you put it, play it that way, it's a great game. The graphics are fluid. They've taken over the graphics engine that they use in the Xbox gaming, which is rather than having predefined animations for each of the moves, it just works out what would happen if the person jumped to try to stick an arm out. So it's essentially making up some of the animations on the fly, or at least going into cached versions that it's worked out in advance. No, it's not American football. If you're looking for a full American football game, you will come away from this heartily disappointed and come up with some of the greatest, bitchiest comments that I have seen on a game review and all about Symbian for quite some time. Where are we? I wish they'd make a Canadian football version, because it's a 110-yard field and you'd get to play for an extra 2 seconds. tongue deep in cheek there. But this is a great mobile game. It gives you the spirit of what it's meant to be doing. It's a very simple goal. It's very easy to understand. The graphics look great. There is skill involved. Although it isn't clear that it's this customized minimal version of a part of the game of American football. But at the same time, I mean, a lot of people would be quite happy with a penalty kick taker for association soccer. So if you think about it like that, this is doing the kick returns action with just you against the rest of the team, then you would probably be right there. It's been brought down in price as a special offer. At the moment, no idea how long that is going to run. It's currently available for £1.
It was interesting that while you were reviewing this, I was reviewing I Must Run, which is also about running. The two games both end up with the same basic premise. I Must Run, by the way, is a 2D game, side-scrolling. You just run and run faster and faster, leaping tall buildings, leaping gaps, and eventually ending up in construction yards and leaping from crane to container and so forth. Unfortunately, I wasn't good enough and fast enough with my fingers to actually get as far as the levels 2 and 3, the construction yard, let alone the subway station, which is also promised. But I was impressed enough with I Must Run that for someone with really good reactions, I think you could have a lot of fun with that. And the only real downside is that when you die, you get put back to the beginning again, which can get a trifle boring. But the levels are all random. The obstacles it puts in your way and the heights of the building, they're all randomly generated every time. So you never really play the same city twice. So I Must Run, also recommended in the Obby store. Now moving on with something that's slightly more serious, Layar, which is an augmented reality browser now available in the store, provides an augmented view of the world around you by overlaying information, so-called layers, onto your smartphone's camera field of vision. So you hold your phone up, the camera shows you what's in front of you, and it overlays on that specific information. Now, Rafe, you've been looking at this. Is it any good? What's the performance like, and what are the data sets like around you?
Well, Layar's obviously quite a well-known application from the iPhone and the Android world, so it's good to see this arriving on the Symbian platform on Nokia devices. I have to admit, I do have mixed feelings about this. You know, Layar typically works best in the urban environment, you know, where there's a lot of information for it to sort of, if you like, the augment onto the screen. And in certain circumstances, you know, Layar does work very well indeed, you know, especially when you're in a strange part of a city or in a new city altogether and you're trying to, you know, find your way around and you're looking for, you know, somewhere to have a coffee or a particular, you know, attraction to go and visit, you know, it can be quite effective. It's worth explaining that, you know, the different layers that it has. I mean, this is an open system where any third party can create a Layar that then becomes available in the application, and the quality of the layers do vary considerably. To give you a couple of examples, one is the kind of Google local search layer, and I've always found this one of the most useful, in that you specify a search term, for example, pizza or coffee, and it will then bring up all the places, you know, in a local search from Google where, you know, those terms match. And so immediately, for example, using pizza, you'll bring up all the local pizza restaurants, and you get a sort of visual indication on screen of where they are orientated in context of your current direction. So it'll tell you which way you need to walk and also how far away they are. Now, I think when you're doing a local search, this is a very interesting alternative to the kind of the flat map based you know, result page that you typically see on local results. However, part of me also goes, it's a bit gimmicky, but I can see how, you know, this is a more intuitive model to follow. The only slight problem I have with it is you do look a bit of an idiot sometimes walking down the street sort of following this augmented reality instructions. But that said, I do think there's a space for this. There are also some quite interesting layers around overlaying digital information. So, for example, you can see one that has tweets that have been sort of recently broadcast in the local area or YouTube videos. Or you can use it for, you know, the kind of what's that city on the horizon over there when you're in the countryside or something like that. And there are many more, you know, some of the more advanced layers. And it has to be said, these don't run particularly well on the Nokia platform when they're using a lot of 3D stuff. Is you can see 3D buildings as they used to be in the past, or indeed are going to be in the future. And so that kind of looking forward and backwards aspect of augmented reality is covered here, and I think is, you know, one of the most potentially interesting. Of course, it's the one that tends to have the sparsest coverage, you know, things like tweets or YouTube videos around you, or pictures from Panorimo and you know, other local kind of context results tend to be quite well populated, but arguably, you know, less immediately useful in the augmented reality aspect. Nonetheless, you know, Layar have done a pretty good job of implementing this on the Symbian platform. As you might expect, it's written in Qt, and performance is generally pretty good. The sort of one fly in the ointment for performance is that all of the information in terms of the layers and the points of information that make up those layers have to be downloaded over the air. So you need to be on a pretty good connection. I would say, you know, a 3G connection is an absolute must if you're out and about. You know, this won't really cut it on a 2G or an edge connection. Things will just load too slowly. But once that information has loaded, it does tend to perform pretty well. And I think the interface of Layer itself has been pretty well refined from its earlier versions on Android and iPhone. You know, for example, when you pop over one of the kind of the hotspots, if you like, one of the points of information, you get extra information up that give access to directions information or the ability to call them. So obviously that's pretty useful if you're trying to get to a restaurant or something like that. I mean, some of the layers have more in that than others. You know, there are hotel layers that will actually let you book a hotel. I wonder how many people really would do that sort of thing, but nonetheless, you know, quite an interesting approach. It then does also have the kind of the flat map interface that I referred to earlier. This is actually powered off the back of Google Maps, and it will overlay sort of a layer on, so you know, in a 2D way, so you can see the traditional map view, which is I think quite helpful to have, you know, both aspects of those together. I mean, augmented reality I think always provokes mixed reactions. It'll be interesting to get some discussion from the team, you know, as to what they think. But I do think, you know, Layer has done a great job of exploring this area and pointing out some of the potential use cases. But I would say that part of me feels that this is the sort of thing that really needs to be integrated into the sort of mapping functionality as a whole. And so, for example, you know, if you were in Ovimaps, you could, you know, activate augmented reality mode and, you know, get this kind of view up. Nonetheless, of course, that's not available yet, and so if you want it, you know, Layer is the application to provide. And I think it's well worth downloading, is this kind of idea of overlaying the digital on the real world. This it's really about contextual sensitivity, you know, linking that physical and digital world, which we've talked about before as being very important, is that sort of user experience in the future. You know, it's very much what Layer is all about. The practicality of it, I'm certainly in two minds. So one of the things we've got coming up on the site is Ewing is going to be off to South by Southwest. He's going to be testing out Layer there. And I think it's particularly relevant at South by Southwest, which tends to be the home of emerging digital trends. So it'll be interesting to see how he gets on there. But before we get him to talk about that, I just wonder whether you, Steve, as sort of a traditionalist, have any view on augmented reality and its usefulness.
I have to say that every time I've tried it for real, I felt a right prat. And I have told Nokia this. Well, I was actually at a focus discussion group in London last year. And we went through these futuristic interfaces they were showing that they could work on if we thought it was a good idea. And as I acted it out, marching around the room with this my smartphone held it in front of me and all these wonderful things potentially happening on it, and I thought, this is just not going to work. You're going to walk into a lamppost, fall down a drain, get mugged. It's just a disaster waiting to happen. I can see it. Sheer coolness of it really hits me between the eyes, and the sheer impracticality then makes me put my phone straight back in the pocket.
So having had Mr. Grumpy on it, what about Mr. Optimistic you? And have you got a different viewpoint for us?
Well, pardon me for descending very slightly into parody, but it's like we're living inside a dream of Bruce Sterling, who's always white on the edge, and I can't do the Bruce accent anymore. But look, this is a cute tech demo. This is a cute tech demo that ticks all the boxes that are current in VCs wanting to find the next best thing. This is a cute tech demo that ticks all the boxes in the next best thing that has no exit strategy whatsoever, and I cannot see how it makes money. From a purely practical point of view, in terms of show me the money, they either A, get bought by Google, or B, get bought by Nokia and OV Maps. Well, B is looking less and less likely because we're going to have to do stuff with Microsoft, and they have their own virtual reality augmented thing, spinny stuff. And Google, you know, they might buy them, but again, it will probably be a deep hole, and, you know, before they do that, they should have a little word with Jari Engstrom just to find out what actually happens. Look, I can't see where the money comes in. It's gimmicky. I'm with Steve. You're going to get mugged. And, you know, quite frankly, you still have that problem of nobody quite knows what to do with this torrent of social, local interaction, user-generated media information. Nobody has worked out a way to navigate it. Layer feels to me like a university project. They got lucky in a couple of competitions, even though there were some incredibly smart judges on the panels, I would expect. But you know, it's just like, oh, that's cute in tech, let's do that. And they've answered a question that I don't think anybody has actually answered outside the set of CSI CSI.
So a slightly sceptical viewpoint from there as well.
The optimistic one. Do you want the sceptical one?
You've still got to use this at South by Southwest as part of the review, Ewan. But
Bruce to do it.
I would point out with all of this, you know, with all emerging technologies, the business model sometimes follows some way behind the idea. But I have spoken to Lair about their business model in the past, and surprise, surprise, it's advertising based. In that, you know, if you're helping people make connections in the physical world, the idea that you can then make commission off that, you know, is fairly apparent. And it's the whole, you know, the same reason that local search or any location business has the potential to make money. It's about making people's lives easier. So I do think there is a business model there. As things stand with Lair, obviously they're going to have difficulty implementing it on their own, which does, again, to go back to the point Ewan made about partnering with someone else. But David, I'm sure as a technologist you have a view on this augmented reality stuff as well.
Just to pick up on a few things that have been said, yes, it is gimmicky, and I think when you think about the practicality of it, I would say it's not meant to be used while you're walking around. Whereas when you have like Google Maps or other maps running, yes, it is practical to be walking on the street, holding the phone in your hand, and just glancing down for navigation cues. I think the ideal usage scenario for Lair is definitely as a tourist information tool, and I think you actually need to be in some sort of observation point, either sat in a cafe or even like some higher point, and using it to look around, almost like a little pair of binoculars with extra information coming up. And then what would be good is if you can get the point of interest, throw it into your maps, and then just do the normal navigation to get where you want to go. And I think in terms of money, I think there could be the idea of having sponsored points of interest, as long as it was done carefully, because I think all the talk about it being a novelty and can't really see that much of a use for it. Well, all these same things were said about Twitter. But the one thing that does bother me is that the sheer hardware intensiveness that's being used in here. You've got 3D rendering, GPS or other location methods, and a running internet connection, and you're running the camera. So it does concern me about how much power it's going to suck down.
David, it sounds to me that you're describing it like a submarine model. You know, people, you know, look around, pop up, go to, you know, move on a little bit more, then look around. I really don't see that as practical. Look, the thing, let's go to the Twitter one. Twitter took years to work out what it was doing, and it's still not making money. It's still pulling down VC investment. It's a great geek tool, Twitter, but it's still not actually bringing in the money. They've started to put in a little tiny alert bar on their iPhone application last week, and the users are hating it, and there's a backlash. You know, people be earning money around it because they're going to get Charlie Sheen to say, hey, why not buy Doritos when you're whatever Charlie Sheen is on this week. So, you know, fairly apparent for advertising. Yes, in the sort of numbers to reward the team and the VCs and the financiers, I really, you know, it's lightning in a bottle, and even simple basic ideas online are still trying to catch that lightning. You take Lair, which is going to need a huge sales team to do this, or even around one country, that's going to need a huge amount of geographical data that's already in isolated pools in Ovi and Foursquare and Facebook and Google Maps and so on. You know, this is, I still struggle. I would love to see 2 or 3 years' time this actually doing something, but I think in 2 or 3 years' time, it will still be a nice curiosity like Second Life that will still be taking in VC money because advertising in the market, local market pickup is just around the corner. The great thing, of course, with Lair is you can see around the corner.
Yeah, well, I think I would say I agree with Riff. It needs to be better integrated with the maps because I think you're saying about the submarine thing. Well, not quite. I think you look at it when you're in, you use it when you're inside and you are stationary and safe, and then throw the points of interest that you've chosen because of the information layers given to you into Ovi Maps, and then just use normal navigation to get where you want to go.
No, I have to say I still disagree, David. I think that the whole point of navigating a two-dimensional surface vis-a-vis the Earth's surface is best done with a two-dimensional program. And I know this is going to sound horribly like I'm just a Nokia fanboy, but the current interface for OmniMap 3.6, I mean, I've been looking at it extensively, doing some tutorials for Smartphone Essentials magazine, plug, but I've just been blown away by how well they have actually done it and how useful OmniMaps is in its current form. I mean, Google Maps for a while, I would say, were probably superior in terms of the sheer amount of data and points of interest and databases, but OmniMaps, I think, I would argue, has now leapfrogged it in various ways in terms of interface. The data is now probably as good as Google Maps, and navigation's better as well. So for me, I'm afraid, David, I would stick with the two-dimensional. I would stick with doing the whole thing in plan mode rather than going to it alternating between 3D and 2D. Rafe?
Now, I wouldn't disagree with you on OmniMaps being very good, but I think there's definitely potential in augmented reality to provide a sort of alternative way of interacting with the device, kind of a alternative user experience, because for all the, I think OmniMaps as a navigation tool works very well in that 2D mode, but in terms of discovering places and searching, and that it's actually discoverability, which you have the same issue in the App Store, I'm not sure that, typing in search terms is necessarily the best way to do things. There needs to be a way to better alert you to the things around you. And I think augmented reality has a role to play there. I do think that current implementations are relatively clunky. But, it's no different, but in some senses, between moving from a list of driving directions, which is, how GPS and navigation programs really originated, to moving to the moving map. And I'm not suggesting for navigation augmented reality is necessarily the way to go, although there's some benefits, I think, maybe to having an augmented reality view, displayed maybe in the top right-hand corner, which sort of shows you the direction to drive, which lane to be in, that kind of thing. That has potential, particularly when you tie it into the kind of nav technology that's going on now with LiDAR mapping of cities and buildings and roadscapes. I think augmented reality, yes, it's one of those things that's been a coming technology for quite a long time, and there's sort of interesting applications in the game arena, but I still think it has a lot of potential to be this kind of thing that ties the digital and the kind of real worlds together, because it does represent a better analog of the way we actually see the world ourselves, looking in a very visual way and then laying interesting information over the top of it, I think is closer to the way, we as humans interact with the world around us than looking down at a sort of a diagram, which is effectively what the mapping becomes. But, it's a debate that will run and run, so I'm perfectly willing to see both sides of it. I maintain a bit of optimism that there's still something there to be to be explored, at least.
Yes, good to hear the optimism, Rafe. And your comments welcome too if you're listening to this podcast on the main story on allaboutsymbian.com. We'd love to hear from you as well. But for now, we're running out of time. We've run out of topics, but we will be back next week with more from Rafe, David and myself. We'll get some input in from Ewan from the other side of the world. And for now, you can find us at Steve Litchfield, at Rafe Blandford, at David Gilson, and at Ewan, also at AAS, all on Twitter, and you can keep in touch with what we're up to. But for now, it's goodbye from me. It's goodbye in Sussex from
Rafe Blandford.
And goodbye up in Scotland from
Ewan Spence, who's pretty sure that Scotland's surface is 3D, not 2D.
Controversial, that. And goodbye in Hull from?
From David Gilson, where it is most certainly 2D.
There we go. Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the All About Symbian Insight podcast.